Welcome to River Cafe Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
I'm going to read a recipe of yours, the summer minestrone, and it serves 10. Well, it might serve 10 of some eaters. Anyway,
you and I could probably finish it off. My guests all love food. But Nigella Lawson does more than love food. Apart from her extraordinary children with John Diamond, Bruno, and Cosima, food is the true focus of her life. I cannot remember the day I met Nigella, because that would be like remembering the day I met my sister or my cousin, for Nigella is family. Together, we've been through sadness and happiness and celebrations of both. Nigella and I might go for months without seeing each other, but I know for a fact that she would be the first person on my bed, and I would be the first person on hers in a crisis. We would lay in each other's arms, and then we would go in the kitchen and eat. Quite simply, she's close to my heart, and quite simply, I love her.
I love you. Oh, that's so moving, Ruthie. Right, and now I'm going to read the summer minestrone. So, 2 garlic cloves, 1 small head of celery, chopped, 3 small red onions, chopped, 4 tablespoons olive oil, 1 kilo of thin asparagus, 600 grams of fresh peas, 600 grams of fresh young broad beans, 450 grams of young green beans, trimmed and chopped, 1 litre of chicken stock, 1/2 a bunch of fresh basil leaves, finely chopped, 300 mils of double cream. In a saucepan, fry the garlic, celery and onions gently in the olive oil until soft. Divide the asparagus, peas, broad beans and green beans between 2 bowls. Add 1 bowlful to the onion mixture and cook, stirring to coat with oil, for 5 minutes. Season. Cover with the chicken stock and bring to the boil. Simmer for 15 minutes. Add the remaining vegetables and cook for a further 10 minutes. Remove from the heat and stir in the basil and cream. Cool to room temperature, then serve with parmesan and pesto.
Thank you. So of all the recipes, you say it reminds you of the River Cafe.
Well, it does.
I feel...
Choosing any recipe is a source of anguish because there's so many I could choose. Mm. And I think I remember having this, I don't know when it would have been, the 80s.
Yeah.
Yep, late 80s.
Might have even been on our first menu.
Yes.
I think it was really one of the first things we did.
And it was like, it was both like nothing else I'd ever eaten and yet so familiar.
Yeah.
There's something as well, I think, it says so many interesting things about food and eating. That the eating at room temperature, I think so many people eat food too hot and too cold. And room temperature, which is something the Italians really get, really allows you to taste flavours so vibrantly. Maybe there's something about it that reminds me of childhood. Not that I ate this, but the although it's Italian, the sweet starchiness of the peas somehow reminds me of an English summer.
Yeah, as well. And I think that a lot of our favorite food does go back to very often the food that we did have as a child or that has a memory. And did you grow up with, because your mother cooked for you?
Yes, she was a good
cook.
Tell
me about your mother.
My mother was a rather fascinating, but I wasn't saying difficult is not a very compassionate way of describing it. She married very young. She was 19. And had her first child at 20, you know, my older brother. She felt things very deeply, but didn't always express it. So would erupt quite a bit. And, you know, she was fantastically impatient. And one of the jobs we had to do, my sister Thomasina, we used to have to make mayonnaise together. And one of us would whisk and one would pour the oil. And whoever was whisking, you know, you weren't whisking fast enough, and whoever was pouring, you weren't whisking slowly.
You weren't slowly enough.
And the tension, you know, so it's so difficult because I remember what I learned, and I remember being in the kitchen with fondness and gratitude, and yet it would be so unfaithful to the truth if I didn't say. It was also a source of great tension.
Yeah.
I mean, it was frightening, but I think I did learn a lot, and she was a very spontaneous cook.
Yeah, but imagine being 19 and or 20 and having to embrace motherhood and domestic life and cook. Do you think she liked cooking? Did she like it?
She did and didn't. I associate my mother with food, and yet she had a very troubled relationship and had eating disorders, which I didn't really think, I didn't really take on board until I was in my teens, I think. And I don't know when it started. And it was difficult because it was really a repudiation of something that gave her pleasure. Yeah. And the heartbreaking thing is, you know, she died when she was 48, and she hit pretty quickly because she got diagnosed. Well, she didn't get diagnosed. I was told by the doctor 3 weeks before she died. I didn't tell her until 2 weeks because I was waiting a bit just to get it, you know, more tests and things. And she said it was the first time, being terminally ill was the first time she could eat without anxiety or guilt.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, that's and tough. I think that, it's so on the one hand, you know, I've learned everything about what cooking is from her. Mm. Not everything. I've learned from you. I've learned from Anna Del Conte. I've learned from Claudia Roden. But I also learned what path I didn't want to go down, and it wasn't that one.
Was your father, did he ever cook?
No.
Never went
in the
kitchen.
He didn't. Occasionally, later on, he would make his own breakfast. Which I think is quite an old-fashioned male thing to do, that somehow they don't feel, you know... Yeah. Cooking eggs is too much of a dent to their dignity.
Because he, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the generational men in the kitchen, men coming in the kitchen. Men, very often Americans will say their father never cooked but did the barbecue.
Yes.
You know, that somehow grilling meat. But
even so, I think he would only make his breakfast, probably.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
I don't know, but, you know.
Yeah. What about your brother? Did your mother concentrate on teaching him or teaching
no,
him
No, he didn't
in the kitchen?
Get taught, although... Yeah. I did teach him how to make, you know, hollandaise, which he loves. But he's a wonderful eater. And I sometimes think, you know, not everyone can be a cook, but good eaters are valuable.
The other night you were here with Bruno, and I've seen you here with children and family and little kids and big kids, and students come here and have just one pasta or whatever. But was it more of a special occasion for your family to go out?
Birthdays. Or occasionally for a treat. There was a Chinese restaurant in King's Road called Choi's.
Oh, Choi's. Yeah.
You know, and I remember that. But it was... I found meals difficult. It's an odd thing. Or family meals. Mm. You know, I was clumsy and I'd always knock something over. And I found myself slightly inhibited within a family group. Mm. I came into my own later. And I think as well, I didn't really enjoy eating. Well, I didn't enjoy meals a lot until I had a bit more control. So I could decide what I wanted to eat. And for that reason, you know, a tasting menu... Yeah. It's my idea of hell.
Also, you went to Italy, didn't you?
I didn't. It made such an impression on me. Well, more than that, it really altered my life in so many ways.
Was it after university? Or
no,
during?
Before. So what had happened was I did in the olden days, you did an entrance exam to go to Oxford. I thought I would like to do German and Italian. So I thought, I pretended at the interview that I was going to go to school there, but I didn't.
School there being
in Italy, you know, in the year between the gap year. But I didn't, and I just turned up with a school friend, and I got a job. We had a job share. So we had one room in a pensione in Florence, and we were chambermaids. And all I would say is, if anyone ever stays in a hotel and wonders whether people try on your clothes and put your scent on, yes, we do.
Yeah, well, and fair game, because you don't leave your clothes on the floor either, do you? Yeah. So you were, what, 17, 18?
No, I was, by then I was 19, I think. Just on the cusp, just about 18, 19. I couldn't say anything. I could say, you know, Mrs. Green has a brown hat or something. And
Signora Verri.
Oh, I don't know. It was just terrible. Yeah. And I was meant to be the one getting us somewhere, and I had no idea, and I couldn't understand when they answered. So there was, it was a pensione run by a married couple who came from Arezzo. Mm-hmm. And they had a son called Leonardo. Mm-hmm. And they had his mother, la nonna, living there. And every now and then they'd go to their farm and she would be left there, and we weren't allowed in the kitchen. But the minute they'd gone, you know, I'd be allowed in the kitchen because she wanted company.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and she was she wanted to chat. And so I watched her cook, and there was something she used to do The thing I remember most is that wonderful Italian way of roast beef, which is almost sort of pot roasted, you know. And I would see her with the oil, put the garlic in, remove the garlic when it was brown. You know, in the north of Italy, the idea of leaving lots of garlic was sort of odd. A very small amount of meat, which then, you know, what is it called? Rosolare, when you brown something. Yeah. So you brown that, add, you know, rosemary, teeny bit of wine, like that, and sort of cook it so it was not quite not fried but not poached, really. And there's something so enormously different, again served at room temperature. And she made puree, mashed potatoes, with, I always feel like saying, whenever people go, Italians don't use butter, I felt like you should have seen her mashed potatoes.
And I think, when you were mentioning about the beef being room temperature, I often think that the only thing that Italians really like at a temperature is ice cream, very cold, and pasta, very hot. I mean, I think that's the thing. Otherwise, as you're saying, roast beef, fish, potatoes,
although I do semi-freddi.
Yeah, and semi-freddi, see, of course. I always let my ice cream stay out.
Yeah, and I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that being in Italy,
back to Florence,
taught me a lot.
Tell me
so
more.
We didn't have an awful lot of money to spend. Yeah. And there was a bar I went to, and you could sit at the bar and have a Campari soda, and you could have a selection of, I suppose they were still crostini, not bruschetta, but with, you could choose different soft cheeses, whether it was mozzarella, burrata, and I'm trying to think which the other one was now. It will come to
ricotta?
Me. There's another one. No, it was creamier. And you had it with a stripe of anchovy on top.
Yeah,
so that's so wonderful. And that could keep you going.
Yeah.
Do you know, that would really keep...
And again, you could go to a bar and have a compartment. You know, that's the difference, isn't it? That you can sit at a bar and have a drink and have something to eat. It was going back to Oxford, a rude awakening then, when you could only go to a pub and have a beer.
Well, I didn't really want to.
Or...
I didn't want to. But what I was going to say about Italy is that I'd been very shy. And, I mean, not at home more than... At home or in the adult world a bit.
Yeah.
And when I had to speak Italian, because I was speaking a different language, I had to be a different person. I was more voluble.
Yeah.
I was less shy. And so I found my voice. And that doesn't matter where you find it. Mm. I felt that I felt
gave you a voice.
Both in the food and a way of being and being with other people. Because I think one of the things that's quite difficult when you're adolescent is that people... On the whole, this is different now. I know there's Facebook and Instagram. Mm. But then people knew you just in the context of your family. And I'm not talking about having a well-known father.
No,
talking about everyone.
Sure.
So they know your so-and-so sister. Mm. Oh, I know your cousin. Or didn't I see you there? And that's fine. But somehow to go into a place and not have all those connections is freeing. Being completely independent, earning your own living, fending for yourself.
I can imagine they loved you. I mean, I can see you in Italy. I can close my eyes and see you.
It was as if I had decided at a young age I wanted to be Italian, and then I sort of proceeded.
So. Yeah. And then did you bring that food back with you?
I did. It made me shop differently.
Yeah.
But it's so difficult because I think it's hard not to love Italy without being romantic about it, and one shouldn't be, because like any country it has its issues, and it's a bit, nevertheless I think one is allowed to have places which in reality and symbolically mean a lot in your life.
Yeah. I have such strong memories. I mean, I have memories, as I said, you know, I don't remember when we met because I just remember just you being in my life and this magnificent woman who, you know, combined all of the food and energy and writing and restaurants and love for John. And,
yes.
And, you know, and I think I might have met John the first time, maybe in the Ivy. And he was so funny, you know, he was just so funny and so attractive. And
he
just
no, wanted he was to absolutely sit there. Gorgeous.
Not a great eater.
No, he was a great eater, but he just didn't like an awful lot. He was picky. And I remember the first time I cooked for him.
Yeah, where was that?
I think at home. It was in my flat in Chesterton Road.
Was it part of your
seduction? No, it wasn't really. And I think I think we were just friends at that stage, but I thought I would cook something. And I think it was based on a Claudia Roden recipe. And there was a sort of courgettes with saffron and some sort of sauce. Mm. And then you made the sauce and you put the you know, chopped zucchini around the chicken. Mm. And I don't know. And John took one look at it and he said, "No gravy for me, please."
That's so John.
I know. Yeah. And, you know, I still think of him that, you know, he adored tinned potatoes.
Oh, I've never seen a potato.
I know.
What is
they're new potatoes in tins.
Oh, so they're whole little
they're
potatoes.
They're cooked. Oh, yes.
Cooked, yeah.
And his idea of a real treat, too, was tinned fruit salad with evaporated milk,
Okay.
I mean, but he did like cooking. He had a sweet tooth.
He loved talking.
He loved talking.
No,
but he did like
table,
eating.
Because I do remember endless meals. Remember that big table you had
Yes,
downstairs?
The big oval table. And
there was a big
and,
table.
Yes, and there was always
people in
you know, people and,
out and
eating, and I don't do children's food and non-children's food, but obviously there are certain things that I'd make that were easier and people liked, and also that thing of sometimes it would just be like an indoor picnic. You know, you can get, you know, bread, cheese, ham, salami, tomatoes, and it just really depends. It's, you know, there's so many pleasures around food.
Mm. And what about the kids eating? Did they cook with you? Did you cook with them?
I always did because I was there.
In the kitchen always.
Yes,
the baby on your hip
completely.
And a spoon in the left hand.
And I remember once going to stay with my brother when Bruno was very little.
Yeah.
When I was cooking, and he put his hand. I said, "Be careful!" And he put his hand on the saucepan and burnt himself.
Yeah.
Yes, and I felt like the most awful person. Mm. But actually, coming to lunch was a child psychologist, I think, and he went, "Nonsense. The best way to learn about danger is in a safe environment."
Oh, okay.
So I felt much better after that.
See,
he said he won't put his hand in the saucepan again.
I wanted to ask you also about restaurants. Do you love restaurants or do you...
I love some.
Because you were a critic for a while.
Yeah, I was.
What was that like?
Well, I didn't do lots like people do now.
Yeah.
I did one a fortnight and I always felt I was representing the reader. So I really wanted to... in a way, evoke, and it's just when I write a recipe, I'm trying to evoke the feeling of cooking something. Mm. I wanted to evoke the experience of being in the restaurant, not, you know, it's not about how chummy you are with the chefs or what you know about a place. It's, are you going to have a wonderful time?
Yeah.
And the theatre of the room and the space and the that wonderful noise of a clink of glasses. And I feel I have less of a restaurant going life than I used to, and that's partly sometimes I don't want to be looked at and stared at, and I feel like I'm a bit on show.
Yeah.
Not always, but sometimes.
Of course.
It depends on how vulnerable or otherwise I might be feeling at any time.
Yeah.
I love going to places I feel at home in, and I love seeing, you know, people who work there and the people, you know, that make. Because it's about exchange, human connection.
As we've said over and over, that food is a connection to our history, to our children now, to our lives, to our friends. It also is a comfort. And so I guess my last question to you, as I ask everyone, is if food is a comfort, is there a food that you go to if you need, not if you're hungry, not if you want to impress, but if you need comfort?
Oh, it's so difficult because I feel like, for me, all food is comfort food.
That's a good answer.
I don't know. So
we
I do
leave
feel
it
that.
At that. You don't have to single one child out.
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, my mother's way of cooking chicken, which is a bit like a chicken soup, you know, so anything chickeny and brothy is a comfort. Rice in some moods. I think that generally, I guess, like a lot of people, I think of comfort food as being something sort of carby.
Yeah.
I mean, bread always. Yeah. But I think in different moods, all food is a comfort. And I think it just, there is such beauty in just the ingredients. And sometimes when you've peeled an onion, the way the skin looks on the chopping board, it's just wonderful. Or I think smell as you grate lemon zest and that changes the air. So I feel it reminds you, you know, you're alive and you're taking pleasure and to be grateful for that.
Well, I'm grateful for you, and we're going to go and take comfort and have some lunch in the River Cafe. Comfort and connection and love. I love you, Nigella.
I love you, darling.
Thank you. This holiday season, if you can't come to the River Cafe will come to you. Our beautiful gift boxes are full of ingredients we cook with and design objects we have in our homes. River Cafe olive oil, Tuscan chocolates, Venetian glasses, a Florentine Christmas cake made in our pastry kitchen, and more. We ship them everywhere. To find out more or to place your order, visit shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
River Cafe Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.